Fred Wolf. It was all just such a crock of shit. I had this one sketch. It was about five idiot guys who were working on oil rigs in North Dakota. And they're drilling a hole deep into the earth, and out of the hole pops sort of a subterranean human, some crazy alien person. And it's Janeane Garofalo. And these five idiots see her come out of the hole, and she tells them that she lives in an underground kingdom, that they've been watching Earth's progress over millions of years, and they have all the answers to any question that we might have about life on Earth, and that she has 5 minutes until exposure to the air will kill her. Ask any question you'd like. Well, when she first pops out of the hole, Chris Farley screams a really high-pitched scream. So after she gives her speech about how they could ask any question they want, the next thing out of Adam Sandler's mouth is, he turns to Farley and says, "What the hell kind of scream was that? When you saw the fish lady pop out of the hole, you screamed like a girl." And then they proceed to spend 1 minute of her last remaining time on Earth arguing over how he didn't scream like a woman, he screamed like a man, and back and forth. The point of the sketch was that these guys were idiots and that they were blowing their chance at, you know, at great knowledge. Janeane Garofalo raised hell with three or four people before I got wind of it that I was being disrespectful to women, in that it is a fault of a guy to scream like a girl. That because Farley screaming like a girl would bring chastisement, she said that meant that women, therefore, are deserving to be chastised for the way they scream. It was one of the most convoluted, strangest, most ridiculous reasons I've ever heard to dislike a sketch.
Janeane Garofalo. There were nights where I had a really nice time. Actually, I had a great night the night Alec Baldwin hosted. My family was in the audience. It was super fun. It was the Christmas show. The party afterwards was incredibly enjoyable. The Beastie Boys were the musical guests. It was just like I had fantasized it would be. I actually had things to do in the sketches. It was very exciting. My family was really pleased. But I was usually embarrassed. My family did not like the show that season. My father felt that his intelligence was being insulted, and I was always embarrassed by that too at that time.
James Downey, writer. The fact is that for all the people who talk about what a nightmare this place is, there have been remarkably few true assholes. People can be difficult, and artists are always difficult one way or another, but it's a trade-off and worth it for what you get. There are a few people where everyone agrees that nothing they give us is worth the pain they give. I wouldn't consider Janeane one of those. In her case, I think she's a very good actress. She's smart and does great nuance. But to me, the most frustrating thing about her is her whole thing about how straight ahead and honest she is, and it's all about the work. I've never encountered anyone who's more into the whole working the press thing. Someone said she had her first press agent when she was like 20, and I can believe it. The year she was here, she spent the entire year on the phone with the press, giving them searching, candid interviews about the show. That's fine, but then don't play like, "I don't know the system." Chris Elliott. My kids watch reruns on Comedy Central, and they'll come to me and say, "I just saw you, half-naked, doing this thing where you're walking into an alien spaceship and you're supposed to be naked." And I'm thinking, fuck, did I ever do that? I seriously have no memory of it, and I think it was just such a miserable experience that I have sort of blacked out a lot of these things. That whole year I was just embarrassed. I think I tried to quit once and, you know, Lauren said no. I'm the type of thing that the show needs, that kind of stuff, you know, blah, blah, blah. I was amazed Janeane actually got out. She had a movie offer, and she was just incredibly miserable. And I guess somehow she got out of it. I think I was with Brillstein Gray, who of course represented Lorne at the time, so there was more pressure on me to stay.
Janeane Garofalo. Although I wanted out after the first week, it took, for whatever reason, until March to make it happen. I talked to my agent and I would talk to other people, and then finally I couldn't take it anymore. I just couldn't take it. And I walked into Lauren's office and I basically told him I was leaving. It wasn't like a debate or a discussion. Plus, I did not sign a 5-year contract because I had a feeling it would come in handy, and I fought and fought against signing for 5 years. I think when I quit, it was the first time Lorne ever respected me, to be quite honest. It was the nicest he ever was to me, even though he was generally nice to me. The nicest he was after I quit. And I think he had a bizarre respect, and then also in some way he hated me, you know? He despised me and was pleased that I quit, pleased that I was leaving, and pleased that I had shown some kind of backbone.
Lorne Michaels. Some people, their whole lives, are just injustice collectors. They're going to find new injustices every day. That's what they do, and that's what they are. There were disgruntled writers, too. Tensions that had existed virtually from the beginning between writers and performers, and between performers who were also writers and those who weren't, flared up anew, perhaps because in the early 90s, SNL had seemed so much more a performer's program than a writer's showcase. Writers may also have been dismayed at the fortunes amassed by some performers once they left the show and went to Hollywood, in one or two cases taking favored SNL writers with them, while the less fortunate stayed behind in New York. Saturday Night Live was apparently being looked upon even by some of its cast and creative team the way the network regarded it, as an ATM rather than as a learning experience or a creative challenge. Terry Turner. Bonnie and I had done comedy writing before. We had written sketches before. Saturday Night did a great thing for us. It knocked all the rough edges off of us very fast. That, you know, you didn't go for certain jokes. You tried to stay smart. You tried to stay current. And if it didn't work, it was really an abrasive situation. I remember one time at the end of one particular piece, Lorne got to the end of it and he said, "And what did we learn from this?" Then everybody snickered and put our piece to one side. I thought, I'm glad I'm not near the window. I would jump out right now. It's a tough environment. It's a good environment. I'm glad that Bonnie and I had each other to lean on. Jack Handy. Jim Downey likes to laugh. It seems to amuse him to think that I was fired from the show. He thinks I'm a really good writer, and so it amuses him to think that the show was so stupid that they would fire me. But I sort of decided I'd had enough of the show and they weren't going to put my deep thoughts on, and so I went to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and just did some writing there. And then finally, toward the end of that next season, they said, "Hey, come back and do some guest writing." I did, and everybody really liked what I did, and so they said, "Well, come back. Come back and work on the show some more." I'd written some deep thoughts for the National Lampoon, and there was a college magazine called Ampersand, and I just knew that getting them on television was sort of a key to promoting them. And I felt like it was really important. I did a book of them, and that was the main point. I knew that to get a popular book of them, television promotion was important. But I think my worth as a sketch writer finally overcame the resistance to putting my name on it. And they proved to be pretty popular. And also they have a utilitarian purpose on the show, which I didn't foresee, which was that a lot of times they need, you know, 30 seconds to move the cameras from one set to another, so they can just drop in something like that. And so it was helpful in that regard. I probably did more than 200 of them. James Downey. To me, it was always, number one, to do comedy about things that are going on in politics or the culture, and do it without confusing or offending the smarter people. I always thought that if comedy is going to confuse anybody, by rights it should be the stupider people. You shouldn't be punished for knowing more. Sometimes there are things on the show that really annoy me. The more you know about the target of the satire, the more you go, "But wait a minute, that's not right, he's precisely the opposite of that." But for people who only have a passing acquaintance with it, it just feels, "Yeah, that's right." One time there was a Willard Scott thing on the show, and the basic idea was that he was a big dumb buffoon, and it just made me crazy. And I was the producer at the time, and I could have killed it, but of course it got big laughs from the audience. But my point was, wait a minute. He knows he's a big buffoon. That's his act. So for us to skewer him by having someone do an impression, the point of which is that he's a buffoon, makes us look like idiots. And if I were Willard Scott, I would call up on Monday and go, "Hey, morons, I was joking and you took me seriously." Robert Wright, NBC Chairman and CEO. When Don Olmeyer first came in 93, we had the issue of replacing Letterman, who'd jumped to CBS, and Lorne had cleverly got himself the commission to do that. And so Lorne was going to be the executive producer of the show starring someone. Someone didn't exist, and Don was very anxious about this and wanted to participate in it. This was the first time they were really together. So we had this sort of open audition, and people were submitting tapes and whatever, and they'd gone through a number of people, and I saw the tape on Conan. Lorne already knew Conan was the one he wanted, and I thought it was the best of all the tapes we had seen, and there were lots. It was the beginning of our relationship with Conan. Don didn't particularly like this, but he did agree that he was the best. The fact that he was totally unknown presented some huge problems for us. But Lorne got support from Don and got support from me and was willing to take on the issue that he wasn't well known. Some of the other people were known, so that was a big deal. But it's worked out well for all of us. Robert Smigel, writer. I left to do the Conan O'Brien show in 93. That's what got me to leave Saturday Night Live. I was always afraid to leave unless I had a really good job to go to.
Marilyn Suzanne Miller. I got very, very little on the air. The performers who were good wrote. I did do a great piece with John Goodman and Mike on a cruise ship, where Mike was doing Linda Richman, and they were playing old Jewish people who could only discuss food on trips. So they just discussed the menus of all their previous cruises, and that was great. It felt like it was a very hard match. It was like a closet full of clothes. The tops were size 14, the bottoms were size 12.
Andy Breckman, writer. For a while in the late 80s and into the 90s, Lorne would bring back the golden oldies, writers from the first 5 years, for a week or two when their schedule permitted. And it was actually great to be a guest writer. Suzanne Miller I met that way. Ann Beats I'd met. I don't recall if she was officially on as a writer, but these people would come back for a season or for a show or two. In those years, when there were guest writers, I didn't sense any tension, and it was actually a great system, because everyone came in knowing the show, and knowing what Tuesday nights were like, and what was expected after read-through, and how Thursday nights worked, and how rewriting worked. Lorne had a pool of these writers that were experienced, and for me it was great, because I was starting work on features, but if you give me 50 weeks and a year off, I can come up with 3 great sketch ideas. Doing it every week is tough, but I kicked butt doing it for 2 weeks. If I had 3 weeks in a row, I'd run out of ideas, but I could always do it for 1 or 2. I never noticed any resentment from the younger writers until recently. I came back with my friend, Norm MacDonald, and there was tension. He brought me and Sam Simon in, and the situation had changed. It was like going back to your hometown and, hey, where's the drugstore? I didn't recognize any faces, and we were not welcomed back. I mean, if I was a young kid writing on Saturday Night Live, I would love to be in a room with Sam Simon and just hear how he thinks about putting a comedy sketch together. Tim Herlihy. I definitely wanted to stay, you know, in New York, and had no interest in going to Los Angeles. And I hadn't had my fill of it like maybe Adam and some of the other guys who left at that time did. They were sick of it. Oh, maybe not sick of it, but they just had done everything they wanted to do. And I still felt like I was learning the ropes. For writers and performers alike, whether during one of SNL's upswings or downturns, the experience of working on the show was singular in their lives, and for better or worse, unforgettable. Some of them look back on it the way Marines look back on the torturous training they got on Paris Island. It was hell, it was horrible, it was mentally and physically excruciating, and they are extremely happy that they went through it and would do it again in a minute. Chris Rock. I left first. I left to go to Living Color. It was actually more of a machine than SNL. SNL, they had little rules, like no one was going to write a Wayne's World but Mike Myers. Your character was your character. Lorne might say, I need you to write a Wayne's World, or it would be very nice if we had a church lady this week, or whatever it was, opera man. But it was still up to you. At Living Color, if you had a hit character, they didn't care who wrote it. Once it was a hit character, it was the show's. It was weird that way. It's not a better way, to tell you the truth. The good thing about me being on Living Color, I got on things that had nothing to do with race. On SNL, I either had to play a militant or a hip-hop guy. If you watch my stand-up, race is 10 minutes of an hour-long show. I talk about relationships, whatever. And Living Color allowed me to talk about other shit. I could do sketches about, you know, funny stores I was in. David Spade. It was weird when I left there, because when you are around Lorne and Jim Downey and some cast members and writers that you think are really funny, you are with some truly sharp, fast people. And I didn't realize it, but when you leave, and you do movies or TV, or whatever I've done since, it's not always the case. And that kind of bummed me out. I did a few movies after, and I did a few smaller parts in them, and I thought, wow. I didn't mind taking orders from guys I looked up to, but there is no one in this room that I think is that hysterical, and now they're telling me what to do. And that started to drive me crazy. Fred Wolf. There's no reason for me to kiss anybody's ass at Saturday Night Live, including Lorne Michaels, who I'm talking about. But he set it up so brilliantly, in that it's like this enormous pool of talent, and they all have egos, and they have to have egos to survive the situation at Saturday Night Live, and it's almost set up like sports teams, a university and a varsity. I always thought that that was a great way to do it, and that you had your varsity, your first string guy out there doing these sketches in the first half hour or the first half of the show, and you'd have second stringers that were so hungry to get on the air that they would do anything they could to make that happen. So they'd write sketches for themselves, and they'd write sketches for the star that they could be included in. And it just kept everybody sort of working as hard as they could to take advantage of the place. Because one of the things I loved about SNL is that it's one of the only showcases left on TV where you can actually vault into star status. Back in the days when Johnny Carson was hosting The Tonight Show, when he had a comic on, that meant a lot. And that comic generally would get a lot of attention in the industry. Those days of that being one of the best showcases for any comedian are gone. Saturday Night Live is still the main place where you could actually say, if I did 3 or 4 years of Saturday Night Live, I would become a star if I'm ever going to become a star. I think it's the case to this day. So anyway, these guys come in and they're so hungry to get on the air, and there's like 25, you know, very talented people and egos walking around there. I mean the writing staff and the performing staff. It's such a big mix, and I don't think there's ever been a show like that, really, where you just have a bunch of people out there vying to get on the air and trying to do their best once they do. It's a remarkable place, because if you survive that process, you're probably going to be able to survive the next 10 years of your career. David Mandel. We were sort of trapped there. There was a bunker mentality. You know, there was the siege of putting the show up each week. And that ultimately meant you were sort of eating and drinking, and in some cases sleeping with these people, the same group of people, and going to the bathroom with them, and, you know, seeing them at their best and their worst. And so ultimately it was very collegiate. I guess that's the best word. It was a lot like freshman year rooming experiences, where you don't necessarily get to pick your roommates, but you ultimately have to try and get along. And then you think back and go, well, there were some bad times, but there were some really good parties, too. Fred Wolf. There are definitely internecine rivalries and fighting and all that sort of stuff, but ultimately I don't feel that that's a bad thing. I mean, I think it's bad if you go in there in a fragile sort of psychological state. I don't think you're going to get cured by spending 5 years on Saturday Night Live. That's what I say about Hollywood. No one goes to Hollywood for the right reasons. No one goes to Hollywood to meet their future husband or wife and buy a house and have kids. They all go to Hollywood because they're kind of damaged and there's something they're searching for. I think it's the same with SNL. You have a collection of 25 sort of damaged people, 13 writers, 12 performers, and they're all trying to get on the air. And the best way to do it is to be competitive and to work really hard and stay up all night and just make sure that you're in the right sketches and trying to get writers to write for you or write for yourself and figure out how to suck up to the host and do whatever it takes to get on the air. And the people who lost that sort of battle are sort of bitter about it, because it really is one of the greatest showcases on TV. When I was going out to Saturday Night Live the first time, when I got hired, I had like a couple months to prepare for it. And I ran into an old cast member who was there from the original season, and I shouldn't tell you who it was, but she says to me, "I heard you're going out to Saturday Night Live." And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "I just want to tell you, that place is evil." And her experience wasn't that great. But she was one of the few cast members that never went on to do anything beyond that show. Lorne Michaels. There's an enormous amount of pettiness in this place, on this floor. You have a lot of writers fighting for time on the show. There's an old Hebrew proverb that if you have 6 Jews in a town, you have 7 synagogues. And I think it's about the same with writers. While they can acknowledge someone else's talent or work, there's always a qualifier. David Mandel. If a guy comes out to Los Angeles and becomes a writer, let's say he becomes a staff writer, and has never worked at a show before or anything, he can rise up, from staff writer probably to like practically co-executive producer or maybe an executive producer of a show, and conceivably not ever talk much to the director, wardrobe people, lighting people, and never have been in an editing room. By the end of my 3 years at Saturday Night Live, don't tell the union, but they used to let me call my own edit session. I could film things. I could do small film shoots. I had had 3 years of experience talking to Dave Wilson about how to turn my comedy notes into notes that would work for him as the director. You learn how to talk to stars. You learn how to calm egos. You learn how to play to egos. You learn that the key to everything is the wardrobe people. Get on their good side and everything gets smoother. And you learn how to make sure that you can talk to the design people. I cannot tell you how important that was, getting to a show and having just some of these skills that, A, no one expects you to have, and B, no one teaches you to have. I can remember being in my first edit session on my first episode of Seinfeld, and you were sort of invited into the editing room to come in and take a look. And I was able to say things and solve some problems that helped cut some time out of the episode, because we were always long on Seinfeld. David Spade. It's kind of like surgery, Saturday Night Live, where you're glad afterwards, but it's hard during. And you say you would never do it again. But it was the reason I got everything else. It's what started me, and it was really the best thing that I could have done. Dana Carvey. It's terrifying. And I can still be scared thinking about it. It's just when you're sitting there at 11:15 and you're getting your makeup and, man, you're so tired you can't even possibly imagine having the strength to do the show. Just very, very, very stimulating. And nothing will ever be quite the same. So you do create sort of a bond, almost like war buddies, with people who are on the show with you. Kind of an instant bond. Chris Rock. Saturday Night Live brands you as professional. No matter what is written about me to this day, SNL comes up. It's the Harvard of comedy, Everybody passed through it. You bump into people. I saw Randy Quaid the other day. He's like a frat brother. I never met him before, but we're frat brothers. I did a movie one time. It was an extra part, damn near. It was Sergeant Bilko. I had a little part, man, nothing big at all. But Dan Aykroyd let me use his trailer when he left for the day. Because I'm a frat brother. It was incredible. Big-ass TV and a stereo system, a place I could relax. You know, frat brother. It will be with me. The fact that I was on the show and had any success will be with me forever, and that's an important thing. Fred Wolfe. Saturday Night Live is the rock and roll of comedy. All comedians envy rock and rollers, and the show has that mystique about it. I've written on a lot of TV shows and never really came close to seeing anything like it. There's something about that show that's phenomenal. I don't know of anyone who was on Saturday Night Live as a performer who clicked. I'm talking about the Lorne Michaels years. And then years later didn't click in another capacity as a performer. If you've been there 5 years and you're not able to do a movie or star in your own TV show, then I think you probably failed ultimately in your career. Lorne Michaels. Very often the least talented people are the very first to declare undying loyalty, because the other people have more choices. To me, it isn't that people shouldn't leave or that it's a betrayal to leave, because I think people have an obligation to their own talent and to express it. The more artistic they are, generally the more restless they are anyway. When people come up to me at the party at the end of their first year and say, "I can't tell you how much I appreciate this, and I'm so grateful for this opportunity," I always go, "Well, let's talk about this in year 6, because that's when it will actually matter. Because now all the power is on my side and you have no power." The test of character is how people behave when they're successful and they have more power. Some people handle it really well. On Saturday Night Live, guest and host are one and the same. Hundreds of celebrities, not all of them from show business, some more notorious than famous, have filled that double role. Some ingratiated themselves with the SNL regulars and vice versa, while others proved uncomfortable, antagonistic, and even in one or two cases, sexually predatory. Tim Meadows. The biggest problem with Steven Seagal was that he would complain about jokes that he didn't get, so it was like, you can't explain something to somebody in German if they don't speak German. He just wasn't funny, and he was very critical of the cast and the writing staff. He didn't realize that you can't tell somebody they're stupid on Wednesday and expect them to continue writing for you on Saturday. David Spade. He didn't want to go along with what the plan was that week, and as a result I think that was the first week that I heard talk about replacing the host and just doing a cast show.
Julia Sweeney. When we pitched our ideas for Seagal at our Monday meeting, he gave us some of his own sketch ideas, and some of his sketch ideas were so heinous, but so hilariously awful it was like we were on candid camera. He had this idea that he's a therapist, and he wanted Victoria Jackson to be his patient who's just been raped. And the therapist says, "You're going to have to come to me twice a week for like 3 years," because, he said, "that's how therapists fucking are, they're just trying to get your money." And then he says that the psychiatrist tries to have sex with her.
Tim Meadows. I love Chevy Chase. I do. He rubbed some people the wrong way, but when he was here, it was like just watching a car accident over and over again, just watching him deal with people. Because he didn't care about what he said. He has no qualm about telling you you're an idiot. But not just saying it, but showing you. You know, treating people really bad and being a real smartass. But I actually like him, though. He didn't call me an idiot. He was nice to me. Chris Elliott. I remember having dinner with John Travolta and Lorne. He talked to Lorne about Saturday Night Live and how it had influenced him, and how he had always felt that Welcome Back, Kotter was kind of the primetime sister show to Saturday Night Live. And I remember Lorne just politely sort of nodding and going, "Right, right," and then afterwards walking back to Rockefeller Center with Lorne and how that really bugged him that Travolta brought that up. I was surprised to hear that we were the sister show to Welcome Back, Kotter. Dana Carvey. Keith Richards, I remember. There was a horse backstage that week, and I was in my dressing area, and I saw Keith Richards go up, hold the horse's face in his hands, and go, "You're a fine horse, aren't you? I'll never forget that. Working with the athletes was great, like playing catch with Joe Montana, because I had a church chat where he threw a football to me. Playing catch and running patterns with Joe Montana. With Wayne Gretzky, we did a Wayne's World thing. I had never been on skates or played hockey, so Wayne Gretzky kneeled down and put on my shin guards. Wayne Gretzky showed me how to hold a hockey stick. I mean, that's like unbelievable. He was the most humble superstar I guess I had ever met. Tom Hanks, host. The second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth times I did the show were just a blast. It's a one-week performance camp where everybody's operating from a sense of just incredible amounts of glee and manic energy, as well as vast amounts of fear and flop sweat. That's Saturday Night Live, and there is absolutely nothing else like it. Kevin Nealon. Music-wise, it was just a dream come true, because I grew up with the Beatles and James Taylor and Paul Simon, and those are people who came through a lot. You know, sitting next to Paul McCartney as he's playing Hey Jude during rehearsal. And Mick Jagger came on the show. And Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam. He's doing three songs, and he's not sure which three to do, so he's asking during rehearsal, "So, what do you think I should do?" So that's why I loved the show, and the only reason I stayed so long is because I loved doing it. I loved living in New York City, and I loved being able to work with all of these talented people who came through every week. A lot of people just wanted to use that show as a stepping stone to get out and move on, but I just loved being there. Al Franken. Paul McCartney was the musical guest. The musical guest usually rehearses on Thursday afternoon, and if we had someone like Clapton or Paul McCartney, 8H would just fill up with people from 30 Rock to see the rehearsal. The place was just jammed. Paul does two songs, and Lorne comes up to him and says to him, "Paul, could you do Hey Jude?" And Paul goes like, "Huh, I'm not sure if I remember it, really." And I go like, "Hey Jude, don't be afraid." And he goes, "No, stop, stop, you'll get it wrong." And then he thinks about it for a second, and he goes, "Okay, okay, okay." And he goes to this guy and talks to him and then sits down, and they do Hey Jude. And Hey Jude was like the song that when you were 16 and you were driving and got to your destination, and Hey Jude was on the radio, you just sat there and listened to it. He's playing Hey Jude, and I'm beginning to tear up and think about what's happened to my life since I've been 16, where'd my life go, and everybody else in the place is beginning to cry. So Saturday, the music rehearses after dinner or during dinner, and we stop blocking and they do the music rehearsal. So again, it's McCartney, and again the place is jam-packed with people. He plays Hey Jude, and the same thing happens. People start crying, and I get kind of misty. And then I see a set. We're doing the Gap Girls that week, and every time we do the Gap Girls, we have the set that has thousands and thousands of dollars worth of Gap clothes in it, including a shelving of jeans, and they always put a guard in front of it so nobody would take any of the clothes. And I'm looking at the guard, and the guard is crying. And, you know, I haven't had any time to shop. So we get to dress, and Hey Jude, and the audience is going like, "Unbelievable. He's playing Hey Jude. I can't believe it." I'm looking at the guard, who's still very moved. I'm thinking, I'm not going to have time on Sunday to go shopping, and I need some jeans. So, on air, the Gap set was dark, and the guard was totally focused on McCartney singing Hey Jude. So I just started looking for some 34-30 jeans and took them. I went to Dan, the prop guy, and told him I took two pair of jeans. I was willing to pay for them. I just didn't want to spend the time shopping. Chris Elliott. Joey Buttafuoco. That was the lowest point for me at SNL, walking back to my dressing room and seeing this guy just walk by me and go, "Hi, Chris." And I just said, "Hi, Joe." And then I had to be in a sketch with him. It literally was the worst year of my life. I went there too late after I had a career. I had already done my own TV show and had 8 years with Dave, and then I got there and it was a huge cast. I kept thinking every show, "Okay, I'll do something next week that's better, you know," and I never did. And the year got away from me, and it was devastating because I think for everybody who's like my age and in comedy, SNL was probably the reason that we tried to get into it. For the first few years at Letterman, I thought, you know, it was a stepping stone to Saturday Night Live. And to fail that miserably there for me was a big deal. David Spade. They say that if you go with the flow, it's always better, and that would be my recommendation to anyone going on the show. If you're going to go on, then just make fun of yourself and have a great time. It's always endearing to watch someone make fun of themselves. You can't hate someone that actually says, "I'm an idiot. I'm admitting I know you think so, and I'm okay with it." And it kind of goes away, and it's funny. But to fight every possible sketch and everything that makes you look not cool and all that is exhausting. Tom Hanks. The Five Timers Club is still one of my favorite sketches. By that time I had figured that the secret of being the host of the show is to concern yourself only with the monologue. Because if you have a good monologue, everybody thinks the entire show was great. If you have a poor monologue, it means you have to go and win back the favor of the people who were watching at home. So by the fifth time, I was like pushing for something slam dunk. We must have a magnificent monologue. And I think Lauren said, "Well, why don't we do something like you get to join a select club?" And that was that. I think that was the first time I met Paul Simon. He did a cameo. So there was definitely truth to the idea that I felt I was entering a pantheon of Saturday Night legends. The other great thing about that five-timers club was they had Ralph Nader outside the door trying to get in because he had hosted the show once. So it's a heady atmosphere, man. Suddenly you're like goofing with Ralph Nader and Paul Simon. Alec Baldwin, host. I did a sketch once in the early days when we did this really silly send-up of Brando in The Wild One. We did the environmentally sensitive one. I do my Brando impersonation, and I roll into town, and Victoria Jackson is the girl I pick up in town, and she's got the tight sweater and the huge boobs sticking in your face. Phil Hartman plays her father, who's the head of a chemical manufacturing company that's dumping waste into the local lake and killing everybody. It was this incredibly silly, silly sketch. In the end, when the chemical factory is exploding and killing everybody in town, I'm offering Victoria a chance to ride off on my motorcycle with me. Phil Hartman beseeches me. He says the line, "Take me with you." And it was just the way he said the line. I always remember that as one of the times I almost cracked up on camera. He just grabbed me and with this incredible yearning, this incredible panic, said, "Take me with you." I thought I was going to piss in my pants in the middle of the show. I can be sitting there in one of those NPR sketches saying wiener and balls and lick my balls and sweaty balls, and I don't think that that's funny. I appreciate that other people do, but Phil Hartman could walk up to me and say, "Take me with you." And he had that little sob inside the line, you know, and I thought I was going to pass out. It was all I could do to keep from laughing. Tom Hanks. I think you figure out after a while that there are some sketches out there that are floating around, and they have yet to land on a show, and they keep bringing them back again. You realize there's a reason these sketches are still just floating around and haven't landed on the show. There have been times we've been at the read-through, and you can tell by everybody's groans that you're reading for the fourth time some sketch that somebody just thinks is great, hilarious, and they're submitting again, hoping that the host will click with it or something will happen like that. I know there was one sketch that we'd actually put on its feet. I can't remember what show it was, but it was called The Penis Song. It was all about us singing this song called Penis, 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 all day long. Penis, 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 Penis Song. It just went on and on and on, and it got cut. And so I thought, well, that'll never be seen again. But then it showed up about three shows later. Somebody else was hosting, and so somebody else got to sing the penis song on TV, God bless him. Can't remember who it was. On one of the earliest times I did the show, when NBC still had standards and practices, we read a hilarious sketch called Jew Not a Jew, which was a game show in which you try to figure out who's Jewish and who's not. Standards and practices wouldn't let it on the first time, but like when I did the show, I didn't know, either the fourth, fifth, sixth time. By that time, there was no standards and practices, and so we were trying to figure out something to do. Then Al Franken said, "Well, how about Jew Not a Jew?" I said, "You guys haven't done that yet?" And so we pulled out Jew Not a Jew, and it killed. It was hilarious. But when you're there for a while, you begin to get... You recognize the patina of a sketch that has yet to be on the air because no one has quite fully committed to it.
Victoria Jackson, cast member. Lauren said I could stay as long as I want, but I was burned out. I was just tired of trying to think of ideas. The only thing I figured out how to write was update handstands. How many different ways can you do a handstand? They had one with a flag on my butt.